Welcome to this very special series on the global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. I am your host, Khudania Ajay, and together we inaugurate our new fortnightly show with the esteemed Irina Shukerman, a US-based national security and human rights lawyer, as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. In the world, according to Irina Shukerman, we will traverse the geopolitical landscape, delve into pressing international issues, and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. Join us every other week as we empower you with the knowledge to navigate the world of global politics. So without further ado, let's step into the world according to Irina Shukerman and begin our journey to understanding global politics better. Welcome to the show, Irina.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome to the show. And a lot of people globally will benefit from what we are going to talk about. We'll understand the power flow in global politics today. So firstly, let's look at this whole world in a different sense altogether, Irina. You know, this was the first time a few months back, you know, the doomsday clock is as close to midnight than ever. And that was one of the reasons was the ongoing war in Ukraine. A few months later, where do we stand together in terms of global politics? Are we much more secure today, or is the doomsday clock moving very closer to midnight? Let's start with this, and then we'll look at the state of global politics today.
Well, I'd say it's somewhere in the middle. I've never bought into the concept of the doomsday clock. I think it's a fiction to create panic and to push certain agendas into a certain direction. If the people are panicking, they will push for drastic measures rather than reasoned discourse. So no, I don't think we're anywhere near any sort of doom, but I do think that the politics today all over the world has become more polarized, less informed, and there's a great deal of tension and conflict and opportunities to react rather than to affirmatively pursue a particular thoughtful direction. And I think we're seeing a certain geopolitical realignment that is based on the tension between long-term interests in traditional alliances and short-term economic and political gain. And I think until these tensions are resolved, these alliances that we're seeing today will continue to be fluid, unstable, leading to unstable and conflicted courses of action by the various actors and stakeholders.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's look at the different issues, different things that are going in global politics. One is the thing that is making a lot of news is about Macron's withdrawal from Niger. What does it mean for the world? How do you assess international power dynamic in the region now? Now they are pulling out their ambassador, 1,500 troops there. And the biggest thing where we want to understand for, especially for this part of the world, Irina, is that why only France? Why not US? It has also got 1,000 troops there.
So let's start with the fact that Macron is being asked to leave. It's not that he's terminating the alliance, it's that his announcement is a belated reaction to the development that happened weeks ago when Niger essentially kicked the French out and terminated diplomatic and military relations after a coup displaced the elected government with a junta of military personnel that was responding to popular pressure, fueled in part by Russian propaganda, but largely anti-colonialist in nature, that has blamed France for unequal treatment, taking advantage of Niger economically, and essentially was calling for decolonization from France. And France, unlike the United States, has had a long term colonial presence and post-colonial presence across West Africa. And for the past couple of years, there's been a number of coups and attempted coups, eventually leading to anti-colonialist, anti-French regimes displacing pro-French regimes. So the US is actually there as part of a counterterrorism contingency, but they do not have significant political involvement. They did promise humanitarian and security aid to countries that that are combating terrorism and that are resisting the Russian entry into the political scene, but they have actually been criticized for being involved insufficiently in African affairs, which is a fair criticism, but what they cannot be blamed for is having any sort of colonial presence simply because they were not there historically or politically. There is, but it's not just the French who are getting kicked out. Actually, the UN peacekeepers were also asked to leave, and 12,000 members of the peacekeeping forces were asked to leave in a lead up to the removal of the French troops, and that was a major red flag. Everyone claims to have been caught by surprise regarding the coup, but this these measures that were leading up to those events should have pointed out where the general direction of this whole situation. So that leaves a very complicated situation on the ground. The French have had a very mixed history in the region. On the one hand, they themselves favored particular families and interests in governments, and they were involved in a lot of political corruption. They were not invested in any sort of building up civil societies or local law and order, and this has resulted in a very unequal situation on the ground. On the other hand, they were effective in terms of combating counter-terrorism troops, and without their presence, we are seeing already a proliferation of jihadist threats, separatism, and a lot of opposition to Wagner and to local governments. And some of the separatists don't really care who is in power. They care about their own interests, which are not being observed by either party. And there's also a dangerous combination of counter-coup forces and separatists joining forces with some of the jihadist organizations, such as Al-Qaeda, in opposing governments and trying to kick the governments out of the territories they are claiming for themselves, and also opposing Wagner's presence. There's a big potential for a regional instability and war. These societies are very tribal. They don't necessarily care as much about national borders as about family and tribal affiliations and interests. So we can see a lot of border skirmishes and tribal movement back and forth, and it's all going in a very unclear direction.
Right. For the outside world, what is it that the France has been there? Is it the uranium deposits that is there? And after so many years of being there, you know, Niger is the world heavily indebted poor countries. It comes under that. And that is why a lot of people, there is a popular support to the coup itself, that a lot of people think that the civilian leadership, which was in power till now, they have not delivered. And now whoever is in power, let's at least they will bring better life for them. How does this work? A lot of countries down in that region are having coups, and military governments are, you know, getting installed.
So there's some truth to the fact that uranium was a major interest of France in the region. France is heavily reliant on civilian nuclear technology for its electrification process, and uranium is, Niger is very rich in uranium, and part of the problem was the disagreement between the public and the government and France over the price fixing, because the population was unhappy with the deal that Niger was getting out of the French. They wanted more of a partnership and less of a France taking a monopoly attitude towards this. So that was a one practical source of dissatisfaction. A lot of it was about optics and history, not necessarily current events, because France is no longer controlling the country, but the local currencies are very responsive to the French influence, and no one particularly cared for the French meddling in local politics. The fact that France was actively backing particular families and interests, regardless of the outcome, was seen as inappropriate political influence. The irony is that the new government is very much doing the same with the help of Wagner. It has displaced the government without any elections whatsoever. It did not wait for new elections to bring itself into a position. And in the 2 years the last administration was in place, yes, it is true that many things were continued to be mismanaged, but it is also true that there was progress on counterterrorism front, and now this populist push for a change is not taking external and other threats into consideration. So this is not going to necessarily solve all the problems. Yes, they got rid of France, but Russia has a very similar, if not worse, attitude. It has been more successful in corrupting governments, which is how it now ended up in this position of being asked to enter the country. But it's still corruption, even if it's a, you know, better managed corruption with more favorable optics.
Absolutely, absolutely. We don't know whether all these military governments coming to power, military leadership coming to power in most of these nations out there. But the good part here in G20 summit that recently concluded earlier this month is that, you know, African Union has become part of G20 now. So help us understand, you know, the outcomes of G20 summit and that what that means for the world for the near future.
So let's start with the African Union accession. It's a significant development, but it's ironic because everyone is saying what a huge breakthrough it is. But, you know, Africa is 54 different countries. So what they're saying is they consider this entire continent, or, you know, a gathering of countries almost as one member. So in the long run, will it necessarily address the individual interests of each state? How can they resolve the tribal issues and the battle between, you know, building up nation states and these tribal and fluid local interests? I don't know. It is true, however, that Africa is long overdue for having some sort of a seat at the table, even if there is a lot of internal disagreements over what that actually means. It is also true that a lot of it comes from concerns first about natural resources, which have become primary concern for many countries in light of the climate change initiatives that require alternative sources for energy, electrification, and these raw materials that are abundant in Africa, and of course the race, the geopolitical competition with China and Russia, with China having gained a lot of influence and ground in Africa. Interestingly, neither China nor Russia showed up at the G20 summit. So this concept of whether these global gatherings are as, you know, unified as once were remains a big question. And what happens later on if they continue to push for alternatives and with the African Union stepping in is going to be very interesting. But it's certainly a significant development. There is this effort to court the global South, to give them incentives to stay with Western countries and to not become subjected to Chinese and Russian political influence, not just economic partnerships.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this happened in New Delhi. So obviously we were watching this very carefully, and now this goes to Brazil, if I understand. So what has been the whole understanding of yours? We're looking at it from that part of the world. Is it what has been the major outcome? There was a declaration finally. Earlier people thought there will not be. I know there will be. There were concerns about a few things, but I just wanted you to understand from that perspective, how does it look like? What has been the gains for some, you know, for nations like India, who has, you know, held this presidency very, very well. And now it goes to Brazil, another BRICS nation.
So it's interesting because it was a huge win for India, first in terms of just having all these countries there. Second, there has been a big outcome, and I'll address it shortly, about agreements about transportation and economic links to Europe, to the Middle East. And of course, this was India pushed for a compromise solution concerning Ukraine and Russia, and the fact that it was able to gain some sort of consensus in itself for it is politically a big victory. Whether it's a big victory for the world and international interest in this is another question, but for India, without a question, it's a major boost, it's a major political boost, and it is showing as a very major emerging global player with a particular role to play. Unlike many countries, it's not seeking to necessarily mediate in every conflict or to put itself in the middle of various controversies, but it has its own interests, it's pursuing them, and it wants to be seen as a major economic and political powerhouse that will be playing a voice in global affairs. Where that voice ends up going remains to be seen via the consequent bilateral and multilateral relations. It would be smart for the United States and NATO to engage more. There is already a great deal of engagement with India on Quad defense issues and climate change and energy initiatives. There's some technology movement from the US, but if US wants to keep India in its camp, it will need to do a lot more. And I think this is the real message here. I think Prime Minister Modi understands very well that BRICS is a vehicle more for messaging than for real economic change. The members are too diverse, too distrustful of each other, and too conflicted to really use this vehicle effectively to push for any common interest, because they don't really have a lot of common interests other than to be seen and respected, as they claim. India and China are economic competitors. They have trade and diplomatic relations, but I think these tensions will only clash more in the future because China is pursuing hegemony and India just wants to be left alone and to succeed and to succeed through soft power, not through military means. But all of this will need to be resolved through diplomacy, through trade, through agreements, and through understanding that these countries will use BRICS to try to push for leverage, to try to send a message to the West. Brazil is a very complicated story. The leader there has been jailed for corruption. President Lula is very much in line with Russia, China, Iran. All three countries are being perceived increasingly as questionable at best by India. It has had a long history with Russia, but, you know, and still has a lot of trade, more even so than before, due to the economic advantage of the current situation. But it also kind of wants to be involved with the countries that don't have a president who is being pursued internationally for arrest. And Iran has become also a problem for India in recent years as well. So they are probably looking for some sort of a shift, maybe towards South Korea, Middle East, Japan, African countries where it has very good relations, even Brazil. And Lula, on the one hand, has ties to all these states, but on the other hand, he is also a pragmatist who wants to stay in power. If China's economy tanks and it cannot sustain the same level of support, if Russia continues to accumulate political problems, then it may seek to kind of shift its weight towards India, towards Turkey, towards states that are seen as a little bit more stable and long-term promising. So that's where there is an opportunity for influence as well, even if right now it seems unlikely.
Right, right. So let's move from G20 to the United Nations General Assembly. How would you look at it? A bit dramatic this time. And at the same time, the president of Ukraine was also there. He went. He met Biden and all the defense expectations that he had. So help us understand that, but along with Canada and the defense bill, to help Ukraine at the same time. Help us understand from this UNGA highlights perspective, from Zelensky's visit to the US, what the outcome has been, how should the world look at it, and then the Canada and its defense bills.
So Zelensky's visit to the UN was, you know, went about as expected. He's continuing to push for international support against Russia. And we must not forget that in addition to the military crisis, there's also an economic crisis, a refugee crisis. Millions of Ukrainians have left the country. How to bring them back? How to ensure economic continuity in Ukraine, reconstruction? All these remain big questions. China has expressed interest in reconstruction in Ukraine. Some people are saying it's too early. There's been an alliance between Japan and Turkey looking to also provide reconstruction assistance jointly. So there's this attempt to kind of put forward some sort of a plan for economic recovery, because this has been a huge crisis. You know, at the same time, Ukraine seems to be making breakthrough in the south through its counteroffensive, but we are still looking at a very long, protracted conflict. The bottom line is Russia is a bigger economy with a bigger population and very significant resources and alliances. It has made a lot of political breakthroughs in the international community. So Ukraine's role in this is not going to be easy. There's multiple ongoing talks and peace diplomatic initiatives behind the scenes. Some people are claiming that Crimea will ultimately be sacrificed to Russia. Others are claiming that a permanent Russian presence anywhere in Europe is going to be a permanent security problem. But Zelensky is doing what he can in trying to kind of channel support. The visit to the US with Biden, that part of it went well. With Congress, not so much. The Republicans are fighting over money, over keeping the government open and avoiding a shutdown. And Ukraine has been a subject of controversy. It's not a huge part of the budget, despite claims by some organizations that it is. But some senators, such as Rand Paul, who have had long links to Russia, have essentially taken the political process over U.S. budgetary, very domestic-oriented issue hostage over specifically Ukraine aid and blew it up into something huge and significant. So now we have finally gotten some sort of a proposal for a compromise solution to keep the government open. There's other domestic financial matters that are being discussed and debated, but joining Ukraine aid into a pivotal question is not really a defense matter, because from a defense perspective, we are spending very little without having to have our troops on the ground or having to do all that much. It is much more of a political information warfare effort, and we are seeing that play out. In Canada, the same dynamic is persistent. The Trudeau government has been supportive of Ukraine. There's a concern that should it not be re-elected, conservatives coming in are kind of on the same side as this isolationist conservative group in the United States and some parts of Europe. And Canada has been plagued by a number of scandals in light of this visit that actually overshadowed a very successful discussion. There was this incident that was due to poor vetting, including some former Nazi individual, right, who was applauded by the speaker.
Hunter or something like that, if I remember the name correct.
And the speaker ultimately resigned. He was sacrificed by the party to avoid embarrassing Trudeau. But there's now been another crisis with India, and that's not going well at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. So obviously with Canada, there is India. What is happening down there at Canada? What do they want? What does Trudeau want? Means, was it necessary at this point in time? If they have so many, you know, proof, why don't they just hand it over to India? Why do just go so publicly? He was recently here. He met a lot of officials here. So why this? I don't know. How? What do you make out of this whole thing that is going on between India and Canada with the state of affairs, the state of politics, the state of international relations between the two countries?
So just to summarize the situation for those in the audience who are not familiar with any of the stories at the UN, Trudeau made a very rare and very dramatic public accusation against India, claiming that the security service assassinated a Sikh activist in Canada, and that supposedly Canadian intelligence had evidence of that. Later on, a US diplomat claimed that the intelligence came from Five Eye countries, the English speaking intelligence alliance, but neither of them said what that evidence was, you know, pointing to the Indian intelligence services. Now, the truth of the matter, that particular activist was not some, quiet political critical journalist or anything like that. He came to Canada under false pretenses. He came with a fictitious, fake documents, a fake name that he gave to the locals, claimed asylum. And all of this comes in the middle of the fact that there is a group of such activists in Canada who are apparently quite violent, politically subversive, and they're known for instigating terrorist attacks inside India, and there's a big conflict. Pakistan and China have all been backing this particular activist, as has been Canada politically. Why it has chosen to take that position, nobody knows, but Trudeau specifically has very close links to China. And there's been a lot of criticism of his handling of Chinese espionage inside the country recently. This public accusation may be a way to try to divert attention from his own negligence concerning Chinese involvement and whatever corruption may there be. Whether or not there is actual evidence pointing towards the intelligence services is unclear, because it is a very risky step to try to assassinate somebody on the territory of an allied country, and not somewhere, you know, when there is a very high possibility of a scandal in the event such action is discovered. Could it have been some other party that has intervened, a rogue faction of the intelligence, a rival from the same circles who was doing a false flag, ISI or anybody else? It's unclear, because we're not seeing the evidence. But what I can tell you, that in terms of the communication pattern, this whole story is very similar to the scandalous Khashoggi situation, where likewise, early on, the US intelligence claimed that the evidence was pointing to the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, but never provided evidence for their claims. And then later on, we learned that several interested parties had a direct stake in political outcomes concerning certain geopolitical events, namely Turkey and Syria and Qatar, that was having a crisis, and various internal factions inside Saudi Arabia. So the pattern is very much the same. There's a very big claim, claiming support from the intelligence community. But notice that all of it is coming from political figures. Nobody in the intelligence community is actually saying anything. So the question is, why not produce an intelligence report? Why not have the director of the intelligence service actually lay credence? Because in reality, that's not how intelligence works. There's a comprised report assessing likely factors and likely scenario. Very often there isn't a concrete evidence stating this is who did it. This is, we're talking about intelligence and not law enforcement. There is a high likelihood, these are the factors that we have considered, and so on and so forth. All of that is reported to the Prime Minister and his people, and they ultimately decide whether or not they find this intelligence credible and what policy they make based on that. So there may have been some reporting about certain factors, but that doesn't mean that there was a conclusive decision. Yes, the intelligence did it, and this is how they did it, and who's responsible. It sounds to me like it was a much less clear assessment, rather from the Five Eyes and from Canada itself, and that the Prime Minister, and he has chosen to make it into a political accusation based on that, but maybe lacking the details that he can turn over. I think he believes it to be true based on the analysis, but there may not be evidence clearly pointing irrefutably that such and such intelligence person did it. They kicked out one diplomat that they accused of being the head of intelligence, but they didn't even claim that that particular diplomat had anything to do with this particular story, just that he was being kicked out because they're mad at the intelligence, not that he was in any way responsible for facilitating that alleged operation. So all of that to me sounds very murky. It sounds like a big political scandal that's growing bigger over nothing. And I do think that the timing has to be political, because if you're investigating intelligence services and you have tensions with the country accusing of meddling in your elections, why have you never heard about it before? Because in the US, there are plenty of countries that are meddling in US politics, and we hear about it constantly. So the fact that there's been this complete mute button on alleged Indian meddling, and all of a sudden turns out that for years it's been a problem, it's, to me, doesn't seem like a very convenient political timing.
Absolutely. Governments come and go, leaders come and go, but the relations between country and its people remain. And without credible evidence, they could have shared something much more credible with the government, they could have investigated, evaluated it, then it's a different story. And that is why our foreign minister, Jaishankar, he said political convenience shouldn't determine counterterrorism. That was at the United Nations General Assembly. And I don't know, how do you look at the relations going forward, getting impacted by this thing, which I guess will never be able to, you know, come into open, because it's just an accusation, and it will be very difficult to come out with anything, because by now, Mr. Trudeau had already come out, if he had anything. How do you look at then this impacting, you know, India-Canada relations, because even Canadian military people are not wanting it to link with the political situation. A lot of exercise exchange is happening there, here in India, with Canada. So I don't know, how do you look at it going forward between the impact of this particular incident on the relations between India and Canada in terms of international relations?
Short term, politically, it's turning into a big scandal, because now Indian diplomats have launched accusations claiming that Trudeau had cocaine in his airplane. The Canadian counterparts rejected that claim. Nobody knows what really happened and whether it's even relevant. Does it really matter whether Trudeau had cocaine on his plane or not? The question is, what does Canada want out of this diplomatic incident? If their interest is in terminating relations with India, they could have just done so immediately. This is completely unacceptable. We demand, you know, XYZ, or we are terminating relations. Instead, they just keep on going. They kicked out this diplomat, but they keep on persisting. Now a U.S. diplomat is coming in. Now, this means that they're getting the United States involved, because they've mishandled the situation. It is not normal for a third party, no matter how close an ally they are, to have to intervene in a bilateral scandal between two states. This is not normally done. The fact that a U.S. diplomat had to go on record with such a statement shows that the situation is already out of control. So what did Trudeau intend? If he wanted a small distraction, why did he not leak it through the media? Then he could have had a small limited scandal. Everybody would have traded a media campaign for a while, and on political level, you know, it would have been a distraction. It would have been forgotten. But he launched an official accusation at the huge international platform, causing complete embarrassment to everyone involved. This is not a situation where you can now, you know, can't move back. You cannot, you know, if you had, he had first privately engaged with the Indian government, they could have said, listen, guys, we don't like it. Don't do it again. Here's what's going to happen if you do it again. You know, and this is what we expect from you now. And then you could have had, you know, toned down the rhetoric, handled it, managed it. When you launch a public accusation out of the blue on an international stage, there's no moving back from this, because now it's a big provocation, it's a big aggressive move, and neither terminate the relations diplomatically nor take any concrete measures. I just think it's a really big miscalculation by Trudeau. He did not handle it well at all. It was not professional, it was not good for Canada's national security, for relations with India, and it's going to be very hard to manage. And it's turning into a big embarrassment for Canada because of the situation with the terrorists being hosted there. Now there's scrutiny about all these people, and it's all over the media. Now it's even reaching UK, because now there are articles looking at the activity in the UK. It's actually turning into a positive boost for India, because from India's perspective, they want those groups to be scrutinized all over the world, because they are a problem for them politically. So if Trudeau wanted to benefit India, this is actually beneficial from a security perspective, because now we're looking at these groups and what they're doing, and we're looking at Canada's handling of this case, and it's been handled very badly. There's a question how somebody comes in the false pretenses into a country, and he's not deported once they find out that he gave the wrong information. He's not arrested, he's not investigated. Why are they covering for a terrorist? And if it was a terrorist that was killed, yes, you still don't want another country meddling in your territory, but what are you doing about your own security issues? Are you, if you're hosting terrorists and you don't even know who they are?
Right, right. Moving on from this particular issue, let's look at Russia's growing relations with the Middle East. Help us understand, what is Russia doing there with the Middle East? What is it wanting there? What is it that Middle East wants from Russia?
So it's interesting, because Russia's interest in the Middle East is not new. People think it is, but they don't know the history. Russia wanted access in the Gulf since before even the Soviet Revolution. From the days of the Tsar, it was seeking access. That's how we ended up with Iran, with the Pahlavi dynasty, a compromise with the British, the annexation of Ahvaz, the oil and gas rich Arab territory that is now part of considered to be part of Iran, and with the Caspian divisions, and Russia looking for an ingress into the area with the issues with Turkey, constant fighting over a century with Turkey, over the then Ottoman Empire, with the access to the Bosporus and the Dardanelles. Russia considered the Middle East strategically important even before oil was discovered. And since then, of course, the energy issue is one of its top priorities, because that's where the money is, that's where the influence is. And now many of the GCC states are also, in addition to just having those resources, they're also wealthy countries that have invested a great deal into various industries, into AI, into technology, into businesses and financial institutions. And so Russia wants that influence as well. And it has been successful, because contrary to what everyone thinks, during the Cold War, when the Saudis and all these other countries were supposedly aligned with the United States against the Soviet Union, some of the actors were, maintained some sort of a communication with the Soviet factions and intelligence factions. And after the end of the Soviet Union, they've invested into the energy sector in Russia and all over the GCC. Russia, Qatar, and Iran formed a gas cartel in 2008, so their relations have grown and cooperation have grown significantly on many levels, not just, obvious security issues and defense issues. And Saudis and Emiratis have also initially through private individual investments, but also increasingly government connections. There's been a great deal of energy-related cooperation, and now in UAE we're seeing gold. Russia's gold is being rejected from imports all over the world, but it has found a very welcoming place in UAE, which is making money from it. And after gold is from UAE, is being sold all over the world. It comes from, a lot of it comes from Africa as well, from Wagner's smuggling of gold from DRC and various other African states. So all of that is finding its way into the Middle East. We are also seeing an effort by the Saudis to mediate between Russia and Ukraine. Why this interest when they were never all that involved in that part of the world politically? Energy issues, energy negotiating favorable term over access to energy in Ukraine, as well as what does Russia have to offer in this context, in the context of influence in Eastern and Central Europe through energy issues. So Russia has very strong geopolitical interest. It's not merely just getting weakening U.S. In U.S. relationship with GCC. Yes, it does want to do those things, but why? Why does it care so much? Because of money. At the end of the day, money is power. And if U.S. is less involved in those countries and Russia in the shots with the most influential members of their families, if they're investing in Russia, then Russia has a permanent access to circumventing sanctions, to procuring weapons, to gaining advancing control around the world, propagating its messaging, active measures, defense and security alliances, intelligence. It has new allies, it has a new power structure in place.
Right, right. There are concerns of, you know, a new bout of violence in the Middle East, and this with an alleged Houthi attack on Bahraini base, you know, drone attack. So what does that mean? What is the reality of it all, and who is behind it?
The real stakeholder here is Iran, which has been using its Houthis as puppets. It has trained them, it has armed them, it has collaborated with them, offered them political protection, but it is using them to weaken the region and to essentially force the countries into its sphere of influence very successfully. So the timing of this incident is unusual because as we speak, there are ongoing deliberations between the Houthis and the Saudis and there are other members of the Arab coalition, the Yemen government, the STC, in Riyadh. It was a huge victory for the Houthis that Saudis, after years of war and tensions, invited them to Riyadh. And United States is thought to be behind this invitation because this invitation happened only a couple of weeks after a major U.S. high-level delegation visited Saudi Arabia. So we are seeing that there's U.S. has made part of its foreign policy this settling the war in Yemen, no matter what the cost. And in large part, their interest is in pursuing some sort of a political deal with Iran. And for Iran, Yemen is key. And having Houthis normalized with the rest of the region and with the U.S. as well is also very much a high priority, no matter what they say. Iran has been quiet. They have not been publicly saying much other than supporting the peace process, but they are the ones who are controlling the Houthis. The Houthis always travel to Iran for meetings with high-level officials. There's even been an Iranian ambassador who later died in the mysterious circumstances in Sana'a. So we are seeing that very much it's centered around Iran's looking to expand its spheres of influence, looking to kind of achieve supremacy in the region through religious, not just political means, gain control ultimately of the two holy mosques, discrediting the Saudi royal family and succeeding in doing so. Because already, without compromising on anything really, It has gotten normalization agreements from all these countries. It has gotten physical access to those countries, financial access to their systems, diplomatic recognition and influence, and it can afford to do so even when its proxies violate the terms of ceasefires and continue attacking allies. And, you know, this attack on Bahrain is a signal to the Saudis. It's also a message to the rest of the world. We are so powerful that we don't have to respect the political processes, the diplomatic processes ongoing. And we can do this to your allies, and you're not going to do anything about it. This is the message to Riyadh, and they're right. Because after this attack with drones, nothing happened. And where are those drones coming from? Are they all from Iran? No. A lot of these drones are Chinese made, and some of them were paid for by Qatar in the past, and there's been scandals about it. And again, no one is doing a thing, not the United States, not the Saudis. Bahrain is their ally. The Houthis are not publicly claiming responsibility, even though they normally do. But there is no one else who would have access to that kind of weapons. ISIS and Al-Qaeda would not do that, and because they don't have those means. They can certainly attack, but through shooting or bombs, things like that. They don't yet have access to sophisticated drones. And it was a huge attack. It killed two people and wounded around 50, which is a horrible, very big number for a very small country like Bahrain. So we are seeing that through Bahrain, which is not normally all that on the front lines of these Yemen-related discussions. It's part of the coalition, but it's not talked about a lot. All of a sudden, by targeting this country, this message is being sent to their allies saying, we've got you. Like, you're going to do this on our terms, or else this will, you know, this is what we can do to you. And you can't do anything because here, they're going to do this, and you're not going to complain or end the talks or accuse Iran of anything. And that's exactly what happened. There's been silence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So moving from that region to the big region and the big impact, that's the China. What is happening in with China's economy? Is it moving towards some difficult times? Will its vision, will its what you call thought process for itself of looking at the world about BRI, what's going to happen? The unemployment numbers and all these things, how is it going to impact? Help us understand this, you know, that what is going to be the impact on China itself, the impact of Chinese economy, the slowdown there, and as well as the impact of Chinese economy on the world if its economy becomes stagnant.
Well, China's made a huge number of economic and political mistakes that has landed it in this position. The real estate bubble was never going to be a real economic substitute. It can only sustain growth and moving people from poverty to the middle class for so long. It's a one-time deal. You did it once, but then people expect their standard of living to keep growing. Third issue was over-relying on industrialization and not really developing its own service sector or manufacturing that's independent of this export-heavy jobs. Now that companies have been moving out of China for years, by the way, prior to this political crisis for economic reasons, China has never, you know, even China has been moving some of its businesses to nearby countries because it's cheaper. But it has never developed independent industries. It has had to steal technologies from the West. It has been employing a lot of people, recruiting them for espionage, but not for real jobs. You know, stealing technology is not a job. It's something that you get paid for to occupy, but it's not a skill that produces anything. It's not growing. It doesn't, spies don't grow the economy. The other political problem is that it has Xi in his fervor, anti-Western fervor, has cracked down on Western companies so much that now it, you know, the, there's a capital flight from the country. Investors are leaving. They are not. They're concerned about having the money disappear for obvious reasons. Companies don't want to be harassed. They don't want to be investigated. So they're leaving, and there's been an effort to galvanize local domestic investment, but that too can only go so far because even domestic investors are scared. You can force them to do certain things, but then at the end of the day, unless you confiscate their money, you can't completely force them to do everything. And if you confiscate all their money, it's going to be like the Soviet Union. Yes, some of the elites will get richer and more powerful, but the economic bubble cannot sustain the economy. There's been also a lot of expenditures simultaneously to all of these things. China has been spending a lot on international projects like the BRI, and it's the situation has gone so bad that it's been trying to recover full investments from small, poor, mismanaged countries like Sri Lanka. And, you know, it's trying to call debts, but when you're trying to call debts from everyone at once, if you're a bank, what's going to happen? Everyone's going to flee. They're going to see, okay, the investor, you know, first of all, I can't pay you all of that at once because that's not what we agreed to. I'm not ready for that. And second, other people will see that you're trying to collect debts and they say, you must be in trouble. And then they are going to withdraw their own investments from you, from the bank. If the bank suddenly comes, you know, so this is what's exactly what's happening. China trying to collect on its debts, actually scared of its own investors. And, you know, the problem is China is never going to admit that none of this is really working, especially not in combination, that it's dragging down its own economy, and that the space of international hegemony is unsustainable. Because for China, the most important thing is to save face, to be perceived as powerful, to project power, and to counter its enemies and to be seen as the number one. So it cannot afford to kind of withdraw and take a step back and say, well, we are going to focus on domestic economy and we have kind of made a mistake here and there. They cannot afford to do that because that will be seen as weakness, and they will rather actually collapse than, you know, internally than admit weakness and lose face culturally. This is a real problem for them. They're in a dilemma. So don't expect China to move away from its foreign policy or its strategy, but do expect them to be a lot weaker domestically. And I think there's a real opportunity here for other countries to kind of gain up financially, economically, and just kind of call out that a lot of these strategic technological announcements are based on outright theft, and there is no real investment into intellectual development in China. There's no export of ideas. There's nothing that's, you know, contributing to anything positive. And start withdrawing investments from there. Stop giving China so much power. Stop giving them power that they don't have and cannot independently develop. They're not self-starters. They're heavily dependent on being in financial relations with other countries. Yes, it's going to be painful, and no, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a very long process because you cannot immediately withdraw from huge Chinese investments without finding substitute investors. So other countries are going to have to step up. I think it's more healthy for US and Europe to have more diverse investors than to rely on one big one with the dubious history anyway. So it's not going to be easy. It's going to have a major economic impact everywhere, but it's going to be necessary because you don't want a country making everyone else so dependent on itself and then taking completely drastic, reckless decisions that are endangering investments. You don't want that to happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you very much for helping us understand this complexities of international relations, and we have covered the whole world in this the discussion, Irina, and I'm sure a lot of benefit, a lot of takeaways will be there from this discussion. So thank you very much once again, and I'm sure a lot of people will benefit from the next, from the other discussions that we are going to have every fortnight that we have worked out on. On this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much.